afternoon. It is an unusual pleasure for me today, not only because I'm surrounded by friends here, but because to my right,
I am on your right.
To my right, yeah. I'll be okay. is a very good and old friend of mine. I met Mike Herb when we were both in Cairo in the early 90s studying Arabic. And Mike was always a person who I learned stuff from because Mike was always curious about really interesting things. And as Mike has gone on in his career, he continues to be really curious about interesting things, and he tells you what he thinks about them. He doesn't tell you what everybody else thinks about them. He tells you what he thinks about them. And I always learn a tremendous amount. Mike did his undergrad at the University of Washington, did his MA and PhD at UCLA working with Leonard Binder, wrote a book called All in the Family about the way monarchies work in the Gulf that I think is still by far the most interesting and insightful academic work on how hereditary monarchies work and how they stabilize themselves. I think in many ways it captured Mike's intellectual approach, which is to figure out why things work the way they do. He has spent a lot of time thinking about the politics of Kuwait and following the politics of Kuwait very, very closely. And that has, I think, been a consistent theme for when he had a Fulbright in graduate school and continuing through. He's now teaching at Georgia State University and working in the Middle East program there in political science. He's going to talk to us about the democracy tax in the Gulf, which people don't really talk about, don't really think about, and what are the costs of having more open and democratic systems in terms of working on things and getting the kinds of positive outcomes that governments strive to do. It is a real great pleasure to introduce you to my friend, Mike Herb.
Thanks for that introduction. I hope that this lives up to at least a little bit of what he is promising here. The basic puzzle that I'm looking at is when I was in Kuwait, a lot of Kuwaitis, and especially Kuwaitis who are from the merchant elite, tend to blame Kuwait's economic problems on the parliament and its problems in general. It's quite frequently said that it is an obstacle to development and so on, and it's engendered a certain almost hostility towards the parliament among some members of the Kuwaiti elite. And so this project is trying to understand if there's anything to that. Because usually political scientists, when we talk about the relationship between democracy and economic growth in most countries, it's usually argued that, in fact, you know, democracy is not a ticket to wealth necessarily. So if a poor country becomes democratic, it's not necessarily going to become rich like most rich democracies. But at the same time, democracy isn't something that one avoids because authoritarianism makes you rich, because authoritarianism does not reliably produce economic growth. But in Kuwait in particular and in the Gulf, these economies and societies work a little bit differently than most countries. And I think in particular there's two ways that the Kuwaiti parliament acts as sometimes an impediment to private sector economic development and diversification. And one of those is because of things specific to the system of government in Kuwait in which power is shared between the monarchy and the parliament. And I'll talk about that in more detail in a moment. The second thing is more general to the Gulf states, and especially to the really rich Gulf states, which are Qatar, the UAE, and Kuwait, of course. So the three really rich ones. And it has to do with their labor markets and the political and economic interests that this creates among citizens. And so let me start with that, and then I'm going to come back around to the system of government in Kuwait. So let me start by talking about the labor markets in the Gulf, especially in these three really rich states. And these states are, again, Kuwait, Qatar, and the UAE are distinguished by the really enormous amount of oil wealth they get per citizen. And they actually get enough oil wealth per citizen so that the state can offer most citizens a job in the public sector, most citizens who want to work. And so in these countries, somewhere around 90% of those citizens who hold a job, who are employees of someone or another, are employees of the state directly or of a state-owned enterprise, the oil company or something like this. And of course, there are a vast, there are large private sectors in these countries as well. But by and large, the way that, you know, it's not citizens who are employed in the private sector. It tends to be foreigners who are employed in the private sector. And so one has in the UAE, for example, the ratio of, well, about 20% of the population are citizens and 80% are foreigners. And some of those foreigners work in the state, but most of them work in the private sector. And when one looks at the private sector, it is very largely foreign. And so the result of this is that citizens' economic interests are shaped by the fact that they are, by and large, state employees. And so in a standard advanced capitalist democracy in Western Europe or virtually any place, citizens have an interest, the average citizen has an interest in the profit or profits in the private sector, because the private sector pays taxes and the private sector employs citizens. And so, you know, there's talk of a class compromise in which capitalists are allowed to make money on the understanding that they, you know, invest and investment produces jobs. In the Gulf, by contrast, that link is broken. And so, for example, recently there's a bill in the Kuwaiti parliament, I think it's in committee at the moment, which is sort of a bailout bill, modeled along the lines of bailout bills, which we see around the world today. But one of the members of parliament, he says, in opposition to this bill, which is meant to bail out investment companies, he says, look, in America, if we bail out the private sector, it pays taxes and it employs Americans. But why are we going to bail out the Kuwaiti private sector? It doesn't employ very many Kuwaitis, and they don't pay taxes. And so what this does is it creates an incentive. I mean, it removes this incentive for citizens to support private sector growth, because citizens, by and large, rely on state jobs, and those state jobs are funded not by taxes on the private sector, but by oil exports. And this is true in Qatar, Kuwait, and the UAE. That's where these jobs, by and large, now Dubai is a little bit of an exception in that, but by and large, this is where they come from. And it goes to the extent that in Qatar, there's a sort of an understood guarantee that citizens have that when they graduate, they will be offered a job in the state sector in one way or another. So it sort of breaks that link between citizens and the private sector. One can see this. There was the Kuwaiti parliament did a survey of Kuwaitis in 2006, and it asked them essentially, what do you want the parliament to do in the upcoming legislative session? And this was driven by the fact that Kuwaiti members of parliament are elected and they want to do what their constituents, citizens, want, you know, care about. Well, I asked them, what do they want? And the first was this idea that the state would essentially pay off the consumer debts of citizens, buy off all consumer loans, which in 2006 seemed crazy. In 2009, actually, you know what? That doesn't seem so unusual. It's not now something which is only Kuwait anymore. But anyhow, this was their first priority. Their second priority was like health and then housing and stuff like this. So things that the government can do for them. There were 19 possibilities that they were given. Three of these had to do with the private sector, and they came in nearly last. The 16th priority was privatization, which privatization promises to move, you know, to take state-owned enterprises and privatize them, which citizens do not think is likely to be in their interest. The 18th was reform of the stock market, and the 19th was encouraging foreign direct investment, and that was dead last. And that, again, is because foreign direct investment is not going to pay, it's not going to result in tax revenues or in many jobs for citizens. Now, it would, however, benefit better-off Kuwaitis, that merchant elite who could build projects and hire a bunch of foreigners and make a lot of money. They would benefit from more foreign direct investment, a stronger private sector. And so what you get then is a form of class politics in these societies in which better in Kuwait, better off Kuwaitis, those who are capitalists and have a lot of capital, tend to be more supportive of the private sector, whereas your average Kuwaiti who is, say, a graduate of high school, whose education is sort of mediocre at best, does not have foreign language skills, and who, if he was on the open labor market competing with all of these foreigners, would be competing directly, to drive a truck, would be competing directly with Bangladeshis at wage rates that are reflective of the poverty of Bangladesh. If it's something which requires Arabic language skills, then he would be competing with Egyptians or Lebanese, and again, at labor rates that reflect the labor rates in those countries. And so, and these citizens understand that. The alternative, of course, is to work in the government, where the wage rates in the government reflect not the open market wage rate, which is set by, depressed or by the poverty of the countries from which foreigners come, but instead by the government's desire to hand out oil wealth to citizens. And so in many ways, this is the way Gulf jobs should be understood. For citizens, it is a way of distributing the oil wealth to citizens. And it is, in fact, the primary way in which the Gulf states distribute wealth directly to citizens in the form of actually cash in their pockets. There's the whole welfare state as well. But the primary way that Gulf citizens get spending money, their share of the oil wealth, is through state employment. And so the average Kuwaiti high school graduate understands that his and her dependence upon government jobs and the difficulty they would have competing in the open labor market. So to the extent that there is political participation in the Gulf for citizens, then we would expect then to find that parliaments in the Gulf tend not to be very encouraging of the private sector. And I think this is what we do find. And so here, let me talk some about the Kuwaiti political system and then compare it to that in the rest of the Gulf. And in doing this, I'm going to talk about some of the other set of problems which emerge out of the Kuwaiti parliament, which have to do with the sort of stalemate, the paralysis in the Kuwaiti political system. Kuwait's political system is one in which there are elections to a parliament in which there is pretty close to universal suffrage for Kuwaiti citizens, who compose about a third of the whole population, but Kuwaiti citizens get to vote, women as well as men, of course, now. And the voting is free. By world standards, Kuwaiti elections are pretty good. The government tries to buy votes here and there, but in general, they do reflect citizen desires. There's a 50-member parliament, but the government, this is a parliamentary system, the government is appointed largely by the ruling family. So the emir appoints the prime minister. The prime minister is always a member of the ruling family and was until like 2003 always the crown prince. Prime minister then, in consultation with the emir and other members of the ruling family and so forth, selects the government, at least one member of whom must be drawn from the 50 elected members of parliament. And so this differs from a traditional parliamentary democracy in that in a traditional parliamentary democracy, of course, the elections, the party with, well, typically the party with the largest number of seats in parliament, the leader of that party becomes the prime minister typically and then forms a government. Well, here, instead, the ruling family or a member of the ruling family forms the government. But the parliament still has some real powers, and its most substantial power lies in its ability to interpolate, or in the English language press, it's said to grill or to question. These are istijwabat in Arabic. The members of the government and the prime minister himself, potentially. And so this interpolation occurs when 1 to 3 members of parliament request an interpolation. The actual event occurs in parliament the member of the government who is being interpolated, and it's just one, shows up, takes the stand. The members of parliament who are questioning him start. They direct questions, and then he responds. And often they direct accusations, some of them fairly scurrilous at times. Then he responds. And then this can be followed up some days later by a vote of confidence. And a minister can be removed from his post if he loses a vote of confidence. The only members of the parliament who are allowed to vote are members who are not part of the government. So essentially, the elected members of parliament, a majority of the elected members of parliament, can remove a minister from his or her post. Now, this has never actually happened, that a minister has lost a vote of confidence. What happens instead is that the interpolation happens, and then everyone starts counting votes. And if the minister is going to lose, the minister resigns. If they count votes and they figure that the minister will survive, they'll go through the vote of confidence and the minister will lie. But it does is not unusual. It's happened a number of times that ministers have, in fact, been forced to resign as a result of their impending loss of confidence, loss of a confidence vote in parliament. And this has happened to members of the ruling family, including some sheikhs who are in the sort of core branch of the ruling family. And so what it does is it makes it so that there is a real accountability that the parliament can exercise directed on actions that governmental ministers take. And this is reflected then in the process of appointment. When ministers are appointed by the prime minister takes into account their likely fate in parliament. If it is a minister who faces wide opposition in the parliament, it is less likely that minister will be appointed to a seat. And so, for example, there's members of the ruling family who it's understood would not survive if they were appointed to the government, to a cabinet post. And so they're not appointed. And then second, once a minister is in power, holding a portfolio, that minister has to make sure that they don't run afoul of the parliament. And in recent years, in the past year or so, it's gotten even more difficult in that it didn't used to be in the past that the parliament threatened to interpolate the prime minister. That was thought to be sort of off bounds. And it's never been that the prime minister has actually taken the stand, as it's said in Kuwait, and actually been interpolated in parliament. But the parliament has started to threaten this. And by threatening to do this, the parliament has been able to force the government to back off of various plans. The most recent one was in some circles, fairly famous Dow Chemical fiasco, when Dow Chemical had this deal to buy Roman Haas, and it required another deal with the Kuwaiti government, where the Kuwaiti government was supposed to provide some billions of dollars that was then going to be a joint venture, and some of the money was going to help to fund the purchase of Roman Haas. And the Kuwaiti government backed out at the last minute. They signed the contract, and then they backed out before they actually handed over the money. And they backed out specifically because several members of parliament expressed their opposition and threatened to interpolate the prime minister. And the prime minister, rather than facing up to this and risking the interpolation, backed down. It happened a little bit before this in November, and that resulted in the dissolution of the government over an entirely separate issue when there was a threatened interpolation of the prime minister. In 2006, when the first one of these happened, the parliament was dissolved and elections were called. And so this is a way in which the parliament really has been successful in exerting some real influence in Kuwaiti politics. And it really is political participation. Now, the problem is this, is that in Kuwaiti, in the problem is essentially a negative power. A reasonable block of parliamentary deputies can stop the government from doing lots of things, the Dow deal and so forth, but they're not responsible for ruling. And so it creates this paralysis. And one of the ways around this paralysis, of course, would be to have a commoner prime minister who would actually have the support of Parliament and who then could do things like the Dow deal, because the Commoner Prime Minister would know that he had the support of a parliamentary majority. Maybe someday she, but for now she. For now, it would be he. And that's the way most, democratic systems work, and why it is possible to pass legislation in parliamentary systems, because the government actually has the support of Parliament. In Kuwait, the government doesn't have the support of Parliament. You've got all these different factions in Parliament, many of which have displayed in the past year or so that they have the ability to have a veto. So that's Kuwait. And so there's two problems then on the Kuwaiti level. First is what I've just described, this paralysis. And second is the fact that there isn't a really high cost for citizens in blocking things like the Dow deal or other projects because they don't pay taxes. You know, the private sector development doesn't result in increased tax revenues or increased jobs for citizens by and large. So there's two problems there. Now, let me I got time. Okay. Let me compare this then briefly to the situation in the rest of the Gulf. There are elections held in some other Gulf countries. In Oman, there were some sort of kind of elections in the UAE, in Bahrain. But in Bahrain's a little bit of an exception here. But in the rest, there might be elections, but the actual parliaments have very little power. So there's very nice elections in Oman, but the Omani parliament, it just doesn't have any power to do anything. So the Kuwaiti parliament can, vote no confidence in a minister and kick him or her out of his or her job. The Omani parliament? No, not at all. The Emirati Federal National Council? Not at all. The Bahraini parliament has a little bit more, but in the end, an elected majority of the parliament there cannot dismiss a minister very easily at all. So essentially, it's not comparable to Kuwait in that sense. And so one of the consequences of this is that, there is a lack of political participation in these countries. And so the people who set policy tend to be those who benefit from economic development. And this is especially the case in Dubai. And so let me trace out then some of the consequences of this in terms of tourism, foreigners, or the number of foreigners, and then also land, which is sort of an unappreciated issue in Gulf politics. First, in terms of tourism, we contrast Kuwait and Dubai. Dubai, of course, has until recently had a thriving tourism industry. But this requires particular policies. It requires alcohol. You cannot have a booming tourist industry without alcohol. At least certainly not on the model of Dubai. And even Dubai's efforts to make itself into a regional business hub, alcohol is pretty important there. Just I've lived in Kuwait a couple times, and you would be surprised at the amount of griping that the expatriates do, Western expatriates do, about the fact that they have to make their own wine and stuff like this, and it's illegal and it's not cool. And it really does matter in terms of attracting foreigners and creating. In terms of tourism and business. Kuwait is dry. It is dry and it will stay dry because the parliament is not about to legalize alcohol. And it was the parliament which was instrumental way back in the 1960s in making Kuwait dry and in making sure Kuwait Airlines is dry. And that policy isn't going to change. And Kuwaiti members of parliament understand. They understand that there are those who wish to build large tourism developments. And they understand it would require alcohol. And they, and even when it's proposed to do this in the outlying islands, to sort of isolate it from Kuwaiti society, they still say, no, we're not going to have tourism, built on alcohol and hotels and stuff in Kuwait anyplace. Tourism requires a certain welcoming attitude towards foreigners. And Kuwaitis can be very welcoming to foreigners, but when you land in Kuwait airport, you feel like you're visiting a city or a state which is for Kuwaitis, and it really is. When you land in Dubai, at least for Westerners, of course, and I understand that people have different experiences depending on what their passport says in this, that's clear. But nonetheless, if you're a Westerner and you land in Dubai, it's very sort of, thank you for coming here, we want you here. And that's because the Dubai tourist industry depends on being fairly welcoming to people. In Dubai, one finds, concerts by Western musical acts. I remember one time I was there, and there was Shakira was going to come, and Queen, and stuff like that. In Kuwait, there was one minister who, part of the reason why he lost his job was precisely because they were holding concerts in which the genders were mixed in the audience. And this was a violation of Kuwaiti norms. And so the parliament, there were other issues that went along with this, but it was one of the reasons why he was hounded out of his job. So you can see here the direct effect here on the possibilities for making Kuwait into a tourism destination. And when you look at the figures, hardly anyone goes to Kuwait to be a tourist. I mean, the figures are stark. The UAE gets most tourism in the Gulf. Bahrain gets a lot because of the causeway with Saudi Arabia. Kuwait gets almost none. If we look at the number of foreigners, now it's kind of interesting. Kuwait has a lot of foreigners. The UAE has more. So the ratio, about a third of those who live in Kuwait are citizens. About 20% of those who live in the UAE are citizens. Emiratis complain a lot more. It's a much bigger issue in the Emirates about the role of foreigners. And it's because they can see that, especially in Dubai, there's an effort to build an economy on the basis of foreign labor. And it requires making creating an environment which is welcoming to foreigners and having foreigners essentially as generators of foreign exchange. I mean, the economy is really fundamentally increasingly built upon having foreigners doing business there. In Kuwait, by contrast, foreigners are largely there, not as generators of foreign exchange, but as generators of convenience for Kuwaitis. And so Kuwaitis are happy to have a whole lot of foreigners because they don't want to, there's lots of jobs that Kuwaitis really aren't happy to do, and they like to have servants and so forth. But it's a very different role that foreigners play in the economy. And this is reflected in the sense among Emiratis that there's a loss of identity, or hawiya, as a result of the really substantial number of foreigners in the country that one doesn't see in nearly the same degree in Kuwait. And again, Kuwait, in other ways, Kuwait feels like a country of Kuwaitis. When you look at the topography of the place, the really nice neighborhoods in Kuwait are the neighborhoods of villas, which are not downtown but ring downtown and are inhabited by Kuwaitis. In Dubai, some of the better, a lot of the Emirati neighborhoods are sort of out a little bit, the suburbs, in sort of to the south and the east of the main city. But if you go to the heart of Dubai, there aren't very many Emiratis there. Finally, land. And land is important in economic development in the Gulf. In Dubai and in the Emirates and in the usual way it's done in the Gulf is that the ruler has undeveloped land by default belongs to the ruler. This is certainly the case in Dubai. And so the way that the ruler and the way that the ruling families, much of the ruling family's revenue in Dubai comes from land development. And that is in no small part what Dubai is. So, I mean, they own the land, and so as Dubai, up until just recently, was developing into was booming as a entrepot. Well, in the end, the ruling family made a vast amount of money from real estate. And the three big real estate companies in Dubai, the biggest one, Dubai Holding, is owned by the ruler personally. And the other two have participation by the government of Dubai. And the government of Dubai is not so much separate from the ruler of Dubai and the ruling family of Dubai and so forth. Kuwait's very different. In Kuwait, the government owns the land, and it doesn't part with it very easily at all. And is one of the major complaints of the merchant class in Kuwait, the extreme difficulty of getting hold of land, especially seafront land, to do developments. And this is because the parliament is extremely suspicious of any transfer or sale of government land to merchants. I mean, little plots for houses, sure, But big plots for developments is really, really, really controversial. And so the way it's usually done in Kuwait is through build, operate, transfer projects, where the private sector is given a piece of state land. They get to build on it, they operate it, and then they give the whole – they never actually own the land. They give the entire development back to the state at the end of 20, 30, or sometimes 40 years. And they're actually willing to do this. I mean, really unfavorable terms for the private sector, because there is – it's very difficult to get large tracts of land in any other way. And so there's – again, the political system results in a very different economic outcome. In the rest of the Gulf, usually – The ruling family is willing to allow private sector development on land because it gains from it. In Kuwait, the ruling family doesn't own all that land. The state owns that land. And then finally, in conclusion, let me just add a couple of points about whether or not this idea of a democracy tax. Well, I wouldn't want to draw the conclusion here that democracy is bad. Democracy is in the interest of citizens in the Gulf. Now, citizens have an interest in their share of the tax of the oil revenues, and that's distributed to them by the state, largely in the form of employment. And there is, I mean, a lot of foreigners and rich Kuwaitis view them as parasites. But you know what? I don't buy that. It is their oil money. And they deserve a share of it in one way or another. Now, is the way that it's distributed optimal for the Kuwaiti economy? Probably not. But at the same time, the idea among many expatriates and merchant Kuwaitis that the government ought to cease to employ poor Kuwaitis and throw them out on the open labor market to find jobs in competition with Bangladeshis is a recipe for depriving them of their share of the oil wealth. And it should be recognized as such. At the same time, in some place like the Emirates, if one were to have a Kuwaiti-style parliament in the Emirates, it would make the sort of development that's been going on in Dubai very, 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 very difficult, because the sort of sacrifices in terms of Emirati identity and in terms of the number of foreigners that the Dubai model of development entails, it's just not something that citizens would support. If Kuwait is any evidence, and if sort of the general sort of state of public opinion that one can sense in the Emirates is any evidence of this. And it would do harm to that very large expatriate population, that large middle class, largely from South Asia, that currently live in the Emirates. And so I'm not, it's a dilemma, right, of democratization. People in the Emirates talk about a democracy in which expatriates would actually be allowed to vote. But then this would, permanently change the identity of the Emirates. And so I think in many ways the ruling family survived by offering the least everyone's second option. The citizens would rather have a citizen parliament. The foreigners, I mean, they're content with the way things are pretty much. But if there's going to be a parliament, they'd rather have it be one in which they get a voice. But everyone understands that the current situation in which there's the ruling families control politics gives everyone a sort of a halfway acceptable sort of middle ground. So with that, I hope I haven't spoken too long.
It's an awful lot to think about, and you put together some things that I hadn't quite put together. One question that strikes me is, while the al-Sabah is not a rational actor,
mm-hmm.
what do you figure collectively they're trying to maximize? Because I understand if you're Mohammed bin Rashid, I think I understand from your presentation, I mean, what the game is.
Yeah.
Right? And they have a strategy, and then you have, I think I understand, for instance, what the Nahyan strategy is in Abu Dhabi. But one of the things that struck me was that I wasn't sure what the al-Sabah strategy was, other than staying relevant.
Yeah, I mean, and as you point out, there isn't the al-Sabah differ on their strategies. And so I guess I would let me offer this as sort of a first, the al-Sabah are in a really difficult position, and they understand it. There is an authoritarian wing of the family that would very much like to close down the parliament, or at least deprive it of most of its powers, to do something like what happened in Bahrain. When Bahrain's old constitution from 1972 or 73 was quite very much like Kuwait's, and then it was unilaterally amended when the current king came to power. And so the authoritarian branch of the al-Sabah would like to do something like that and rule more in the style of the rest of the Gulf ruling families. The problem that they face is that the al-Sabah have never ruled through repression. They dabbled in it, you know, just before the Iraqi invasion, but they're not very, they haven't done it very much. Their strategy has long been to try to, you know, to earn legitimacy by sharing some measure of power. And so that and abandoning that strategy would really require, I mean, if they were to close the parliament or to unilaterally amend the constitution, one would expect to see street demonstrations. One could see an occupation of the parliament building. One would see a lot of unhappiness among many Kuwaitis. And it wouldn't just be that sort of, you know, Kuwait is divided into those who are Hadar, or the settled sort of old Kuwaiti families, the urban families. And then there's the more recently settled Bedouin in the outlying districts. And traditionally, the group that's wanted, supported the parliament, has been that settled old Kuwaiti. But I think if the parliament were to be closed today, there would be opposition from across the spectrum of Kuwaiti society. Sunnis, Shia, Bedou, Hadar. Not everyone. And some of the merchant families would be delighted. But there'd be a lot of opposition. And the ruling family would have to figure out how to put that opposition down. And it would not be easy. It would not be pretty. And some members, when one hears from those who are in positions, who sympathize with the authoritarian option, one hears a certain amount of despair about the costs that would be involved and how ungovernable, to use one word that I've heard, Kuwait would be if it were to be shut down. Now, that's not if they were really absolutely determined, of course, I think they might be able to make it work, but it would be costly and it would be difficult. And then there's the other branch of the ruling family whose strategy is to maintain as much influence and authority as they can while understanding that Kuwaiti parliament, the Kuwaiti politics is drifting towards a stronger parliament. And now that might not be a really always wealth. Well, no, some members of the ruling family explicitly, you know, see it in those terms. Others are just kind of muddling along, right? Trying to do as best they can in the situation that they have. And in the increasingly sort of narrow set of constraints that they have. So, but there is a really strong sense in Kuwait that things are not going the way they should, and that there's some serious problems in the political system. And it could, I mean, one possible result would be shutting down the parliament. Another possible, the more likely one would be continuing to muddle through. And the third would be some, I'm not predicting this anytime soon, but certainly one thing that's talked about is a commoner prime minister from outside the ruling family who would have some of the more difficult posts, like the Ministry of Health. I mean, then the parliament would be, that ministerial post would be more directly responsible to the parliament, while the ruling family would maintain the ministries of foreign affairs and defense and those core ministries. That's another possibility as well. But it would be hard to achieve, because one of the things you would need to do then is to, it's a very fractious parliament, and to actually have a prime minister with support in the parliament, you actually have to develop a parliamentary majority from all of these people with all of these different agendas. And it would be, all these little blocks that make up the Kuwaiti parliament.
But can they get a majority to take people down?
Yes, they can get a majority to take people down. But see, the thing is they might get this majority to take down this minister and a separate majority to take down that minister and another majority to take down that minister, right? To have a parliamentary system, you need to have a fixed majority that supports the parliament today, the same majority tomorrow, and the same majority the next day. And it requires more parliamentary organization of parties and blocs. Because to just take down a minister, you don't. All you need to do is just collect enough votes. But to provide a stable base for a government, you need some stable, a reasonably stable bloc in the parliament. So, and it's fractured. I mean, it makes the Israeli parliament, for example, look like a model of sort of organization, right? And
are you suggesting it's not?
Oh Lord, okay. I guess I'm merely comparing the two countries on the basis of their shared sort of parliamentary and semi-parliamentary systems here, and that's the only basis on which I am comparing these two countries.
Okay, why don't we go Brian and then Molly and then Lauren and Kristen. Can you identify yourself, by the way? And so sure. You know, alternates three rules. One, identify yourself. Two, please ask only one question until everybody's gone. Three, please ask your question in the form of a question, which is not to give a statement and say, what do you think of my statement?
Brian Kinstrel, Center for American Progress. How are the economic difficulties, the great contraction,
yes,
impacting the politics of Kuwait and the other countries that you mentioned? You see snippets of this, but how... What impact is that having, plus the sharp rise in oil prices and then decline over the past year? How's that percolating through the system, and what's your prediction of where that will go in these countries?
Well, there's two things. First, this policy of more or less universal government employment could get hard to maintain if oil goes down much farther, right? But not in Qatar. Qatar is pretty rich, and they just don't have that many citizens. It would make it so that someday, you know, they will need to actually have private sector employment for citizens, and it makes it a little bit more likely. In Kuwait, you know, it sort of accentuates that class difference. But I think it's in the UAE where you really have an interesting possibility, which is that Dubai has maintained its autonomy within the federation, and it's really furiously defended that autonomy over the years. And there were some real efforts in the 1970s by Abu Dhabi and the ruling family of Abu Dhabi to impose upon the UAE a constitution which would have strengthened the office of the president, which is always held by the leader of the Abu Dhabi ruling family, and would have reduced the autonomy of Dubai. And that was fought off by Dubai. And as a result, Dubai was able to pursue its very distinctive development model of trying to integrate into the global economy, bring in foreign lots and lots and lots and lots of foreigners, and the tourism and everything else. Now, to the degree that Dubai is hurting for money, the place it has to go first and foremost is Abu Dhabi, and of course Abu Dhabi has vast amounts of money. The money in the Emirates is in Abu Dhabi. Dubai is because there's just a vast amount of oil there, And they're still very, very solvent in Abu Dhabi, of course. Even in this crisis and everything, they still have vast amounts of money, and they could bail out Dubai. And the questions that aren't clear are, is, first, how badly is Dubai hurting? And clearly it's hurting. But how, you know, just how much of a bailout are they going to need? And what price tag is Abu Dhabi going to put on that? And would that reduce the economic policy-making autonomy that Dubai has enjoyed? Now, if this had happened in the 1970s, if Abu Dhabi's autonomy had been reduced, one might have seen a development more along the Kuwait model. But I think today, you know, and if we look at Qatar and Abu Dhabi, they, you know, up until the beginning of this crisis, they were talking about imitating Dubai. Dubai was the model in the Gulf, and that meant, you know, this economic diversification and globalization and the big, huge projects and the tourism and everything else. And you can see this in Doha, right? But now, you know, if they might decide, that is to say Abu Dhabi and Qatar and so forth, that they want to continue on that track, in which case they can weather this downturn because they have a lot of money. And then when things start looking up again, they might go full bore ahead with this sort of policy of trying to turn their little city-states into these entrepôts and business centers and so forth, but ones that still require a whole, you know, a lot of foreigners, an environment friendly to foreigners, and so forth. But you can see this, you know, Doha moving in that direction. But they can do it more easily than Dubai can in this environment because they're solvent. So anyhow, so we'll see.
Holly? The United States in terms of whatever the rhetoric is going to be about democracy and rights and elections and market economy and the like?
I think I can speak first looking backwards. There was a sense, you know, around the time of the invasion of Iraq that, in fact, there needed to be more elections and so forth, and that maybe the United States was serious about this. And then for a little while after that, then of course, you know, with the problems in Iraq, the pressure really, really went off these regimes in no small way. And the Palestinian election outcome, and the whole, you know, and, yes, all of that. And so, I don't sense that they think that there's a whole lot of American pressure. In the place where American pressure would perhaps be most useful and needed is Bahrain, where, you know, the American pressure is least evident because of fear of the Shia, right? And the degree of but it's just tragic in some ways. I mean, and I would also, you know, finally add that in Kuwait, I think that an American role in encouraging the al-Sabah not to close the parliament would be very useful, because I think it would get the al-Sabah into a lot of trouble with their own citizens if they did it, and would probably put the United States into the position of having to take some stands on democracy in Kuwait. And so, and I wonder sometimes if the degree to which there's an American commitment to, you know, maintaining the parliament, even despite the fact that it causes a lot of, you know, it creates this paralysis. I think this paralysis is better than closing the thing, so, and better for the U.S.
Laura?
Thanks. Laura Schultz from the Congressional Research Service. My question relates to whether you see this, the citizen versus kind of foreign labor dynamic in these countries as sustainable, and specifically, does, you know, the current economic crisis, as well as, I think, what many would say is a growing awareness of abuses of this, of the foreign labor sector. Does that have any impact on this equation and how these governments might be looking in the long term?
Is it sustainable? Up until the economic problems, it really looked in some place like Dubai that it had simply spun out of control of citizens, that it was hard to see how it would go back to a situation in which citizens could have political control over their own country when citizens composed only 20% of the population, which is why in some quarters, at least, the crisis was welcomed in Dubai by citizens, because it meant that there weren't going to be so many foreigners there. But I don't know what it means. You know, and so in the long run, you know, then it wasn't... I think it could have been sustained in the sense that it would have just pushed the question of political reform down the road indefinitely, because you couldn't have political reform that would satisfy both citizens and non-citizens. And so in the very long future, perhaps you would get, you know, a real democracy in which the people who actually lived there would all get to vote. But now maybe, you know, depending on how deep the economic crisis is, maybe this provides Emirati citizens with a way to regroup and actually capture control of their country in some sense, but I doubt it. So, in Kuwait, is it sustainable? Yeah, I mean, just until the oil runs out, and then when the oil runs out, it turns into a place more like Bahrain or Oman, where you actually do need the private sector to provide some jobs for citizens. So, but even in Saudi Arabia, there, you know, these new economic cities and such, Saudi Arabia can't provide a job to every citizen. They just can't do it. They need private sector employment. But even then, in the sort of the end years of the boom, there was a huge amount of foreign labor came into Saudi Arabia. And that's just really directly, frontally against the interests of sort of middle class and poor Saudi citizens, because it brings in people against whom they have very much a lot of difficulty competing on the open labor market. But of course, capitalists have no desire to hire citizens because they cost more. They're used to the working hours of the government, which are like maybe 5 hours a day, and they're virtually impossible to, or they're very difficult to fire. And this is nothing cultural, right? It's all the economic incentives that face citizens as opposed to non-citizens. So I hope that answers your question more or less.
Professor Dewan.
Kristen Dewan from American University. You presented a really elegant model of political economy and allowed you to do a lot of work kind of comparing these different states. And I want to make it even tougher for you. So I want to throw another layer on there and get your reading on it. And I want to know, how do you see Islamist politics mapping onto this political economy that you presented?
Yeah, they're empowered because they enjoy a lot of support among the citizen population. They have much more influence in Kuwait than elsewhere. And one sees this reflected in policies having to do with alcohol. And again, when one visits, Kuwait, and in the past, of course, Kuwait was seen as a model for the Gulf. It was more liberal than the rest of the Gulf and everything else. And it still, of course, is more liberal than Saudi Arabia. But when you compare it to Doha and to Dubai and so forth, yeah, I mean, it feels more conservative. And this is because the parliament gives a voice to Islamists that they do not have in, for example, the Emirates. And they, obviously in Qatar they have it to some degree through Al Jazeera and so with Qatar Dawi and Al Jazeera. But still, it is you can sense the loosening of sort of.
To take Kristen's point further, does the government deal with Islamists in a markedly different manner because of their support in parliament, or is it only a question of degree?
Islamists in the Emirates, one gets the sense from talking to people who are identified with, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood, that their concerns are things like defending those who have been let go from government employment because of their Islamist beliefs. By contrast, in Kuwait, the Muslim Brothers have, or did up until they decided they didn't want one this time around, have seats in the cabinet. So they're much, or and the Salafis in Kuwait have a certain level of political power, and it's understood that having some seats in parliament translates into some influence in the government as well.
Well, and then they have a constructive. I mean, what I hear you saying is they have a constructive agenda, whereas Islamists in many other states just have a sort of defensive agenda. Is that fair? Not really.
Yeah, well, people often haven't usually been using constructive and Kuwaiti parliament in the same sentence in recent but they have proactive, or they have a concern that is not just simply creating some space for themselves to function. Instead, they have programs that they actually want to accomplish, and parliamentary games that they want to and they want to play the parliamentary game in order to win the rewards that can be secured from that. So,
can I just ask a really quick follow-up? Are they on? Do you see the Islamists being on both sides? Are they playing completely the populist game, or are they also on the side of things? Because there are a lot of Islamists.
No, they're
split. In these sorts of things as well. So,
yes, they are split, and so you find someone like Khalid bin Sultan, who is this very prominent Salafi, who's also from, he owns the Sultan Center, and his family is involved with Agility, this big, huge thing. And so he's a very rich merchant. And yeah, so you can see this in some of his statements about the economic crisis, where he's taking a not very populist stance at all. But you get some Islamists from the outlying districts, the Bedou, where people aren't as educated, and yeah, they're populist. So it tends to... It's something that splits the Islamists in Kuwait. Yeah.
Jim?
It seems to me that there's been a parallel throughout
the world. Jim Platt, Cambridge Energy Research.
Between the politics of the economics and overall. Because what keeps killing is oil. It kind of flows independently from the oil. It went to that very nice place. What would be the prospect, do you think, if this deterioration continues? The ruling family just deciding that the Amir rules by decree. It's been that in the past.
I think it would be bad. The way it would be, it's been done a couple times. One was in 1976 and one was in 1986. And, you know, they got away with it then for a while at least. And it's just unclear if the immediate consequence, I think, would be street demonstrations that would force the regime to decide just how repressive it wanted to be. And I talked to one person who favored this and was in a position of some authority, and his take on it was that he wasn't sure that if they closed it down, if the result wouldn't be that it would strengthen the parliament because the ruling family's bluff would be called. And they would wind up, you know, in an even weaker position. So, now, it could be. I suppose they could do something rash. There could be a clash, the clashes, and yeah.
Tom Raines from the State Department. Using your economic model, I wanted to ask you: do you think that popular perceptions in Kuwait and in the UAE are rational, in the sense that, at least in Abu Dhabi, a lot of your government employees, because of access to capital, have private businesses on the side.
Mm-hmm.
Very active in an economy that depends upon the foreigners, and they live off of foreigners, they're renting apartments, cars, you know, you name it, foreigners.
Mm-hmm.
Is that also the case, or not as much the case, in Kuwait? Or is it really more of a cultural preference that in Kuwait, if we want to go have that fun time, we don't want to pay when we're home. We don't want to see Westerners in jogging shorts or South Asians walking along our Kuwait beach so much.
It is both. And, of course, within the UAE, I know Kuwait better, but my sense of the UAE is that it tends to be the other, like Ras Al Khaimah and places like this, where citizens don't have the sorts of, you know, this government plan in Abu Dhabi to give loans so that citizens could build homes and then rent them out to foreigners, where that sort of thing doesn't happen nearly as much, where the sense of unhappiness with foreigners is higher in places like Ras Al Khaimah. But again, it ties in with the more one benefits from the capitalist end of things with foreigners in the country, the more friendly one might be to it. But at the same time, you know, there's still costs for those Abu Dhabi citizens of having a country with so many foreigners in it. Yeah. So I hope that. Yeah.
I have a question from the far left.
I'm Lindsay Stevenson. John, but I just wanted to ask really quickly, a lot of people have been calling for one district in Kuwait. There were 25, now 5, and now they're calling for one. So I'm curious to see how you think that would shift alliances and how that could change the situation maybe in the future with a commoner prime minister, if that would help or hurt the situation.
Yeah, currently Kuwait has... It had 25 electoral districts with 2 members each. Now it has 5 with 10 members each, and the idea is to go with one, with 50 total. And the way that might change things is by changing the way that citizens vote. Because at the moment, you get a big long list of names, and you choose 4. And the top the candidates who get the top 10 vote winners. Are elected. Now, that would be a little bit more difficult if you had just one list of several hundred candidates to choose from. And so in a one-district system, the most obvious way to do it would be to go to parties or something like this, or more formal lists. And that would tend to strengthen then parties in the parliament if you go to a party system in voting. And so that would be one possibility of how things could change. And so a lot would depend on the not just the number of districts, but what voters see when they actually go in to vote. Do they see parties then, or do they just see 200 names? And so the consequences of those two different things would be very different. But there was thought that going from 25 to 5 would really change things. It didn't.
Must have said about giving women the vote too. Whoever says it's going to change everything, it didn't change.
It didn't change much. But parties in conjunction with one district would change things. The other thing that would change would there be more Shia in the parliament. So.
And Shia are currently 4 seats, yeah. Something like that?
Yeah, something like 4.
3 seats?
And it's...
And 15 to 25% of the population?
Yeah, people disagree about just how many, but say 20 to 25%. And lots of people say 30, but I think that's high. So.
Kristen.
I think you described really well why there's a stalemate in Kuwait and why there's really rational reasons on both sides and why most of the citizens don't have an interest in moving forward with the kinds of economic development that are envisioned by the capitalist class. But I'm just wondering, is there any way to get out where they could make a deal? I mean, to some extent, the capitalist class should recognize this, and if they can structure things in a way that citizens would benefit, some kind of state-based investments or things like that, would there be any way to get out of this? It does feel very much now like a
rational mass. One can certainly imagine some sort of a deal in which the number of – in which capitalists are allowed to pursue projects that employ Kuwaitis rather than foreigners. And – or alternately, projects which employ a lot of foreigners but in ways that are hidden from Kuwaiti society. So say, on the one hand, one could have projects, you know, that are off, you know, on Bubayan Island or something like this, where there are almost no Kuwaiti. It's isolated from Kuwait City, where you have lots of foreigners doing industrial stuff like you do in some parts of Abu Dhabi. That's a possibility, I suppose. Another possibility would to be to really sharply limit the number of foreigners and to have more of a free market economy. And this in which Kuwaitis actually do work in the private sector, but in which they're not directly competing to drive trucks with Bangladeshis. Because that's what really the difficulty is here. And it's, you know, I mean, that direct competition with Bangladeshis means that Kuwaitis become poor. And so, you know, I think there are probably ways of working it. If the government no longer was providing, had enough money to provide a job to every Kuwaiti, it would certainly drive the process along faster. But again, the second problem then is doing anything given the nature of the political system. So that makes it harder to arrive at, to accomplish much of anything. So.
Maybe we get a last swipe in? Yeah.
Change the topic a bit. Stephen Garrett with the Department of Commerce. Could you expand a little bit on why you think Bahrain is more open to U.S. influence than the rest of the GCC?
U.S. influence in terms of its the receptiveness of the government, or in terms of the social mores, or are you? The Bahraini, the Al Khalifa ruling family is Sunni, and the majority of Bahrainis are Shia. The Al Khalifa conquered Bahrain, and they captured the land, and they set up sort of an economy in which the Shia worked the land, and the Al Khalifa benefited from it. And Bahrain today, in many ways, sort of that historical legacy lingers. And so the security forces in Bahrain are virtually exclusively Sunni. Many of them are from other countries, so Syrians and Jordanians and Saudis and so forth. And it is so all of this would tend to explain why the ruling family might be more receptive, in the sense that they understand that they need, that they are in a potentially vulnerable position if the United States starts talking about human rights for the Shia, who are really quite thoroughly discriminated against in Bahrain, and for whom the United States really probably ought to be talking more about their rights, and the fact that this is a resolutely Sunni regime ruling over a majority Shi'i population and you see the nature of the regime and the composition of the security forces. So Kuwait's nothing like that. The UAE is nothing like that. This is sort of a Bahraini thing. So.
Stephanie Williams, State Department, asked me if I could crystal ball. I mean, sort of touched on women's participation in the Gulf briefly. And I know that it's relatively a new thing in Kuwait in terms of getting the votes. Maybe 10, 15 years down the road, I mean, one could surely be optimistic that women would bring more to the table in both the business sector and hopefully the political sector. Do you see that happening? When I served in Kuwait, one of the arguments that the Islamists, or even not the Islamists, in fact, the liberals used against giving women the vote was that the conservative women would just vote with their husbands.
Yeah.
This would increase the power of Parliament, which I thought really belittled.
It was interesting. You could see the first election, and when women were allowed to vote, they actually reported the results by some precincts were for women and some were for men, and you could compare. And yeah, it did not. They tended to vote for Islamists. In roughly the same proportion as everyone else. So it wasn't looking forward, a woman came in 11th in one district. So she almost won a seat last time. If she had come in 10th, she would have had a seat and she would have been the first elected female member. And I think that over time that we'll eventually see some women win seats. And elections are hard fought in Kuwait. There's a political class which had developed support and had by serving in the Majlis al-Baladi, the municipality council and so forth, had developed bases of support, and they were all men because only men could do it. And so I think it makes a certain amount of sense that it's going to take a little bit of time for women to develop those networks and for women who are capable of, have the political skills required to win elections for them to emerge and actually develop support bases. And I think when that happens, you'll begin to see some women in the parliament. But all that said, clearly women are happy to vote for men in Kuwait, and I don't see that. I would, until that changes, the most we could hope for, I think, would be a few female members of parliament. But, maybe as time goes on, it'll change. So. But I do think that we'll see some female members of parliament, in the coming elections. Elections tend to happen fairly frequently in Kuwait, so.
As often as Israel. Mike, I gotta thank you. This has been just really thought provoking. You connected a whole bunch of things. I think there's a lot of interesting data that you laid out. I'm grateful to you for coming up and speaking to our friends. I'm thankful to you for coming, and we look forward to seeing you all again soon. Thank you.
Thanks.